How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
WBEZ is supported by Impact Grants Chicago. Over 400 women come together in a unique model of collective giving. Each member contributes $1,000, and together those donations grow into $100,000 grants for Chicago nonprofits that address critical challenges across the city. By pooling resources, individual gifts multiply into greater impact. Listeners can learn more about Impact Grants Chicago and past grant recipients at impactgrantschicago.org/join2025.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. It's Friday, so you know what time it is. It's time to catch up on what's been happening across Chicago and Illinois in our weekly news recap, where we take you behind the headlines with local journalists working on stories like these.
A Chicago City Council committee has greenlit a $14.75 million settlement in a wrongful conviction case.
I would have preferred that John Burge was not torturing confessions out of people.
The proposal would allow Chicago Police Superintendent Larry Snelling to issue a curfew with just a 30-minute warning.
No one here thinks it's perfectly acceptable for large groups of teenagers to take guns out of their backpacks and to engage in violent behavior.
City Council passed the so-called snap curfew for young people. I will veto this ordinance.
To help make sense of the week's news, we spoke with Paris Schutz, political correspondent for Fox 32, and Revy Bashwal, anchor of ABC 7's 5 and 6 p.m. newscasts. Also, Francia Garcia Hernandez, who covers Pilsen, Little Village, and Back of the Yards for Block Club Chicago. We started with the city council members passing a hotly debated teen curfew. Paris gave us the details.
Well, this is the so-called snap curfew, although the sponsor, Alderman Brian Hopkins, says don't call it snap because it's not like the police can just snap their fingers and then there's a curfew. They have to confer with the mayor's office. They have to have intelligence that a gathering is going to get out of hand. Then they need 30 minutes to inform everybody that a curfew is going to go into place. Now, this could happen anytime at any place throughout the city. Mayor Johnson has been opposed to this, but it passed city council by a 27-22 vote. Alderman Hopkins says he knows the mayor's going to veto this. The mayor said he's going to veto this. They do not have the votes to override this veto right now.
Yeah, Alderman Hopkins, who sponsored this curfew and whose second ward includes the Streeterville neighborhood, right, which we know has experienced some of the more violent teen gatherings, he tried to reassure critics. Here's what he had to say.
This will be used in a constitutional and effective manner, and all the notice requirements that are in the ordinance will be adhered to.
Now, that was not enough reassurance for Mayor Johnson, who finally made his very strong objections clear this week.
Offering up police power, extended police power without any check or balance, has not bode well for black people and brown people in this country. It is the necessary step, you know, so that we don't find ourselves in a situation where 20, 30, 40 years from now, we look back and we end up engineering the same type of carceral state that we're trying to disrupt.
Revy, I know you've been following the back and forth with this. When you think of where we've landed here with this passing and the passing of this measure, what do you think it tells you about the mayor's aldermanic support or lack of it?
Well, I think, first of all, it has to be seen as a little bit of a loss that it actually passed, even though it didn't pass with a veto-proof majority.
Right.
That being said, it really does illustrate two fundamentally different views of A, what is going on in the city, and B, what is the solution to this and how real a threat this is. I mean, we all know people, we've all interviewed people who live in the Streeterville area who very progressive neighborhood to be sure, part of the whole Barack Obama coalition and all the rest of it, who were very scared when some of these incidents happened last year and before that, and see a kind of anarchy that can instantly kind of blow up in their neighborhood and feel that these kinds of solutions are the right solutions. And then, of course, you have a very eloquently stated rebuttal to that by the mayor, saying that this is part of a philosophy that actually doesn't work and he's not going to have any part of it. I think the fact that to get a veto-proof majority on it requires about 25% more aldermanic votes for the mayor.
They needed 34 alders needed to pass it to make it veto-proof, right. But only 27 did.
Right, and that's a big jump. So clearly the philosophy, at least, clearly the mayor has a position here that he's going to be able to back up.
Yeah, he says he will veto it. That would be the first time, Paris, since 2006, when Richard M. Daley voted an ordinance being forcing big box retailers to pay higher minimum wage. Could this veto drive a deeper wedge, you think, between Johnson and city council?
Well, it's surprising that a mayor let a vote like this get this far, but this mayor isn't so concerned about losing these votes. Like we said, he will win on the policy. He'll be able to veto it, and they need 7 more votes, and it's going to be very difficult to get that. But I think that both of them, both the mayor and the alders that support this, are playing to their political bases. This is good for the mayor. The mayor's ideology is such that he would never have supported an ordinance like this. So he believes in investing in youth, more programs, more after-school programs, basketball tournaments, things like that. He does not believe in criminalizing young people, and you heard his concern about that. It is targeting black and brown people. There is a worry of racial profiling. One of the alders claimed, you know, why don't we ever have this conversation after Lollapalooza or after the Pride Festival, which is going on this week. So on a political level, and there's going to be a race for mayor pretty soon, yeah. Hopkins looks good to his base. Like, well, you know, he's trying to do something about it. And Mayor Johnson looks good to his progressive base, saying, no, he's sticking up for his progressive bona fide. So that's why, honestly, I think they let this get to this point.
Yeah, Francia, I mean, Paris brings up a good point there. We just heard from Mayor Johnson, police haven't had a great relationship with black and brown communities, as well as young people. So what do you think? Are there fears that this kind of police power could criminalize young people with just 30 minutes notice?
Yeah, that's what we've heard from young people and youth advocates and youth programming servers, you know, and providers who say youth, especially in the south and west sides of the city, lack access to programs, safe spaces, and even accessible places to be and hang out.
Yeah.
Many of them come to the, you know, downtown, the Loop, looking for that entertainment or for something to do. And they fear that, you know, nevertheless, there have been incidents, but they fear that some of those youth who are here trying to enjoy their city might be caught up in these.
That's the thing. Yeah. And CPD Superintendent Larry Snelling's been supportive of the measure. But last week, we heard him tell a federal judge that he would, quote, never use that snap curfew power, Paris. What did you make of that?
So this has been very mysterious because the alders have said basically Snelling called them and said, I'd like you to support this.
But now he's like, this is not something I asked for or need.
And so he made those comments in a hearing for the consent decree. So these are comments that are in the court record. And basically what he said was, you know, I'm never going to use something like this on a snap judgment. It's going to take, you know, hours and hours of research and intelligence gathering that says, okay, there's a group that wants to cause trouble. We've monitored the social media accounts. So it's kind of confusing. It does seem like, according to these alders, like Hopkins and others, they say that he was supportive of this, but perhaps Snelling does not want to look like he's going against his mayor. I mean, it's important that the mayor and the police superintendent appear to be in lockstep on a lot of these issues, and perhaps Snelling wanted to make sure that there wasn't any perceived distance.
And, you know, I think the citizenry has to be very aware of what the politics and the optics of all this is. It's about the fight that you want to have and want to be seen to be on the side of. It's not just the straight line argument about the policy. Is this the correct way to deal with this situation or that? It's about being seen to be fighting for what you want politically. And it really puts the police superintendent in quite a position, but clearly shows what a kind of operator he is as well. I'm actually really admiring at some level the political sophistication I imagine is going into his decision making about how is he going to speak about this, especially the use of that term snap. That itself is something that is designed to evoke a kind of a reaction depending on what side of this argument you are on or not. Snap, hey, we can bring safety instantly. Snap, hey, your constitutional rights don't matter in this situation. It's all about the fight that you want to be seen to be having.
Yeah. So if the mayor does veto this curfew, as he promises to do. Where does that lead him if, hypothetically, we see another teen gathering get out of control?
And remember that it's going to be really hot this weekend, and that's when things boil over and tensions mm-hmm. rise, and lots of people are already out. Now, it's going to be, I think, for the law and order folks, so to speak, the more moderate folks that are aligned with aldermen like Hopkins and Brendan Riley, it's going to be proof that this is on the mayor's hands, that the mayor should not have vetoed this. But I don't think the mayor hurts himself with his base. You know, the progressive base, more policing is not the solution that they want. So they're not going to connect those two things. So
yeah. Again, if there is gunplay with minors involved and there are injuries or worse, I think immediately this becomes less of a philosophical argument, and it becomes something that becomes a number one issue in the city.
Well, that's how you could get seven more votes in city council. You yeah. might have seven city council members on the fence here thinking, okay, this is pushing me the other way.
Yeah, and let's point out, this is not,
let's
it's
hope
not
it
just,
doesn't happen.
It's not just Chicago, though, that's having these teen trends, right? Five arrests were made at a teen gathering in West Suburban Naperville last weekend. What mm-hmm. happened, Revy?
Well, allegedly, they found that a 14-year-old was carrying a loaded semi-automatic pistol at a downtown teen takeover. That happened last weekend in Naperville. The authorities there are stressing that they have zero tolerance for this kind of behavior right there. And the mayor and the police chief weighing in, talking about people's constitutional rights and the right to get downtown and the right to hang out in beautiful downtown Naperville, which is just a great place to be at. But since May 1st, there have been planned teen takeover events in Naperville, each varying with different levels of participation.
Yeah.
And last Saturday, they had this, and it resulted in five arrests and a 14-year-old with a gun. So
yeah.
that's not going to go down very well in a place like Naperville. And it shows that, to the mayor's point of view, a mayor's perspective, there needs to be programming. There needs to be places to go for young people to mm-hmm. hang out, especially as the weather gets warmer. But it's not just a Chicago problem. And if it's happening in Naperville, it's probably happening elsewhere.
Absolutely. James Gibson was the latest person to receive a multi-million dollar police misconduct settlement. Revy, what should we know about him?
Well, he is one in a long line. Chicago to pay something like $23.4 million to settle three police misconduct cases. The council agreeing on Wednesday to pay these to resolve these cases. And so that means with this case and others, less than 6 months now into this year, Chicago taxpayers have spent something like nearly $190 million to resolve something like two and a half dozen lawsuits.
Yeah, just this year.
Just this year. And we're not even halfway through the
not
year.
Not quite, yeah.
And they have budgeted, $82 million for this. So we're way over budget, probably more than double over budget. And as you said, I think off the top here, it makes Chicago a real leader in this business of suing the police. And where is this money going to come from?
Yeah,
there's no question. There's a huge question about where is this money going to come from to pay for these lawsuits?
That is the big question. And it's funny you say that, because here's what James Gibson's attorney also had to say about this city.
When people think about Chicago, they think about former President Barack Obama. They think about First Lady Michelle Obama. They think about Michael Jordan and Oprah Winfrey. What they don't think about is Chicago is the wrongful conviction capital of America.
I'm curious what you think, Francia or Paris, because we cover this topic so much on Reset, these police misconduct settlements. But you think we are the wrongful conviction capital of America? Or is that a stretch?
I don't know what the records are in other
right.
cities. I mean, I think this
gotta
is a,
crunch the numbers
this
real
is a
quick.
Problem in many big city police departments. And in the last 10 years, it's something like, you know, more than $500 million. And it just keeps going.
Yeah.
And we can never seem to close the book on this horrible chapter.
Either way, it just sounds like we're just shelling out a
where
lot of money.
Where there was police torture under John Burge, torture, wrongful convictions, false confessions. It's like the city can just never recover from the stain of that.
Yeah. Can I just put it in perspective, okay? $207 million since January of 2019, resolving 55 lawsuits brought by people who were wrongfully convicted based on evidence gathered by the CPD. That $207 million, what could you do with $207? Can I just tell you a very quick funny story? I play hockey with a bunch of personal injury lawyers, and I... Which is funny because we're all kind of, you know, indulging in torts on each other all the time. But that's allowed. The funny part is I know personally lawyers who this is their business. This is absolutely something that they decide that they want to go into after law school. And, you know, coming from Canada, mm-hmm. I had never seen this level of fighting with police departments on a legal level like that. So
yeah.
it is, we need to point out that this is, it is a rather strange development.
It's astonishingly lucrative for the lawyers to do that. Not to say, like, both things can be true. This is a very sorry chapter, and hopefully the police with the consent decree have moved on from this to some extent. But there are personal injury lawyers that like as Ravi said, this is what they do. They pour over records to find sometimes victims, and it's incredibly lucrative. They're getting a percentage of these hundreds of millions of dollars that are getting paid out.
Yeah. Francia, an ordinance stalled that would have allowed Alder's discretion to ban Airbnbs. What were the details of that measure?
Yeah, so this was an ordinance introduced to give aldermanic power, their favorite tool, mm-hmm. to decide when an Airbnb is proposed to open in their ward, if they can veto that from opening. This would not affect established Airbnb or other short-term rentals, mm-hmm. but it would now give them the power to decide whether new Airbnbs or short-term rentals can open in their wards.
Yeah, and it sailed through committee last week. Why did they delay the vote in the city council?
There was opposition from business groups and realtors saying this could violate property owners' rights to, you know, who decide to rent out their properties. Mm-hmm. But it could also, it brought up concerns that it could diminish the funds dedicated to domestic violence in the city, since Airbnb tax dollars are used to fund those programs.
Yeah.
And olders are not all on board with going forward with this measure.
Mm-hmm. Another measure that wasn't voted on had to do with rideshare drivers, Ravi. And it was dropped because Uber reached a deal with state lawmakers. What's this about?
Well, it seems to be a great move by both sides to take this outside of the city's power structure and make it more of a state issue to allow Uber drivers to, under a new proposed law, to be able to unionize even if they're still independent contractors. Now, Lyft wants to get in on this deal as well at the state level, and so that takes away what the city was going to do, or a proposed ordinance that would allow drivers to unionize here in the city. So it takes it to the state. It allows it to have sort of a more uniform application of what this kind of status would be across the state, and it's actually modeled on something that's going on in Massachusetts, allowing drivers to have some sort of collective power to conduct their to basically bargain collectively to be able to get a better deal for themselves. So I think it seems to be a little bit more of a sophisticated way of approaching this. And what Uber was saying is that if you let the city ordinance go in, we're going to have to lay off 10,000 drivers here. And we all rely on Ubers a lot and Lyfts and so on.
Yeah, we do.
That would be enormously disruptive.
Mm-hmm. Controversial Northwest Side Alderman Jim Gardner of the 45th Ward was cleared of ethics charges, Paris. Remind us what the allegations were.
Well, the allegations, he's faced a kind of laundry list of allegations. A, he did have to pay a fine for basically erasing comments that were critical on his social media, on his Facebook. You know, as a public official, you can't do that. This mm-hmm. is free speech in the public square. Also, you know, he was accused of retaliating, using sort of city services to retaliate against a resident that's constantly in his hair. Well, he doesn't have any hair, but in his head. And basically, there was proof or there was evidence that, you know, this particular resident was being slapped with city fines. But what happened in the Board of Ethics basically ordered that he had to pay this. But then in sort of the adjudication of this, there was new evidence that came to light. And at the end of the day, the Board of Ethics said, look, we're just gonna have to drop this because there's new information. This is not good. We're not going to get this done in the time frame. And Gardner gave a very impassioned speech. I mean, one of the most emotional speeches I have ever seen anyone give on city council, you know, basically saying his name was cleared. This was what amounted to a witch hunt against him. That he's a proud servant, a public servant of the city.
Wow.
And this really had soiled and slandered his name. Now, Gardner has been accused of many things. And we had reported years ago that the FBI had been investigating him for allegations of bribery. Now, what came of that investigation, I don't know. It doesn't mm-hmm. seem like much. But he's cleared of this.
Yeah.
But there have been other things that he has been accused of.
Before we take a pause, Paris, in other ethics board news, The chair is going to be stepping down in July. What did he have to say about his decade of service?
Well, I think that the ethics board under William Conlin really grew some teeth. They were really much more aggressive in fining people. And you see in this Gardner case, he had faced a potential tens of thousands of dollars of fines. They had basically existed before that to sort of like be the people that it's like HR, like they go train people on how you uphold ethics, but they really didn't have much teeth as an agency. Under Conlin, that changed, and they have put out tens of thousands of dollars in fines against alders, and perhaps that'll be a deterrent. He's hoping that that's a deterrent for the kind of bad behavior. Look, if being federally convicted isn't a deterrent, I don't know what
don't
will
know
be,
what
but
be.
But that's his legacy.
Thousands gathered in downtown's Daly Plaza and throughout the suburbs on Saturday for what were called No Kings events. Francia, do we have an accurate count yet of how many people attended?
It depends on who you ask. Organizers say 75,000 people flooded the loop, but some crowd experts say it might have been closer to 15 to 20,000.
Okay.
Nevertheless, we know it was tens of thousands of people who marched on Saturday following other demonstrations last week, protesting ICE raids and immigration tactics that we've seen across the country, especially in LA, and the deployment of the National Guard in LA in response to protests over there that emerged after ICE raids in downtown LA and other suburban areas.
Yeah. Evanston, Oak Park, Des Plaines, Highland Park, Geneva, other suburbs. They also held events. This was all coinciding with the military parade in Washington, D.C., marking the Army's 250th anniversary and President Trump's 79th birthday. Did it seem, Francia, like these events went smoothly? Tell us more about what you were hearing from folks.
For the most part, the Saturday march in the Loop and suburban areas was peaceful. There were some arrests, but it was under 20 arrests, at least in the city downtown. And most protesters with different groups and different affiliations, and some of them just, you know, regular neighbors and citizens showing up to protest Trump's agenda, were peaceful and had messages, strong messages against what they have called, you know, a fascist regime or authoritarian measures, the, you know, deployment of military to LA, ICE raids, and the promise of more targeting of immigrants in Democrat cities like Chicago. So there were a lot of messages, but essentially the message was to stand up against Trump and his immigration policies.
So many messages coming from the White House lately. Chicago's Daly Plaza rally, it began with a moment of silence, actually, because just hours earlier, Minnesota Democratic State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband, they were assassinated in their home. And a separate shooting left a Minnesota state senator and his wife wounded. Paris, I mean, the suspect, I hear, also had this written list of names and other possible targets, including some Illinois politicians.
So he had, like, extensive research on politicians across Midwestern states.
Goodness.
And, yes, included on that list was Illinois congresspeople Nikki Budzinski from downstate, and then Raja Krishnamoorthy from the northwest suburbs, who is running for Senate. Now, what authorities said was that they weren't necessarily on a hit list. There was a much more narrow hit list. This was a wider sort of list of names that he was researching. We don't know exactly why these names. Governor Pritzker said that he was not among those on the list, but we did learn, shockingly, that Governor Pritzker was in Minnesota just hours before this happened, giving a political speech with the governor there, Tim Walz, and Hortman was in attendance. So this is just hours after her life is taken. And Robbie, I'm sure coming from Canada, you never expect to come to the United States and cover an environment where political assassinations now are becoming shockingly more of the norm.
Yeah.
You know, you have to recognize, though, that there is an enormous series of these kinds of events happening. You've got that. You've got everything that's happening as it relates to Israel. You've got that young couple who were diplomats in Washington. They were gunned down. Political violence has always been a feature of American politics, sadly. And people have to recognize how it's one issue, one example after another. We had Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. They tried to arson his house while he was there sleeping during a Jewish holiday, and so on. That these are not happening in isolation. These aren't just one-offs. They are part of a series of events that the citizenry has to look at and say, this is actually itself a problem, not just the fact that this incident happened.
And what the experts say, we've spoken a lot with Bob Pape from the University of Chicago. He runs the Project on Security and Threats, and he's been putting out all this research on political violence in the United States. And what it finds is that members of both parties, or folks that are across the ideological spectrum, are now more willing to accept political violence as a means to solving problems, which is a stunning situation. What he says is the solution is that lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have to come together. For instance, President Trump and Tim Walz should give a joint statement, or President Trump and Governor Newsom of California. It doesn't seem like they're going to do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's one thing if everyone, you know, condemns this individually, but they need to come together, and people need to see them, you know, coming together and saying, look, politics, our differences politically end there. They don't. And we're not seeing that right now.
Can I just say the example of what probably they need to do goes back all the way to 9/11, when President George W. Bush, one of the first things he said after that tragedy was, we are one country, we are unified, we cannot look at one group, Muslims or anybody else, and call them the enemy. We have to be unified as Americans. And that really did calm nerves in a very fraught time. And that kind of messaging isn't out there at the top
levels. No, the opposite. We talked about that tweet that Trump put out, or the truth, you know, about targeting more Democrat-run cities, saying the sleazy, leftist, deranged, all this language that's incendiary about his political opponents. And by the way, you know, half of all undocumented immigrants live in red states. He has said nothing about ramping up targeting of red states. And he'll say, well, because the blue states have the sanctuary laws. But still, this is political.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to inflame more of this tension, more protests, because this doesn't solve the problem, that kind of incendiary language.
Yeah, well, back here in Chicago, a pair of U.S. congressmen were turned away from an immigration and naturalization facility on Tuesday. And then Wednesday, a few more representatives were denied entry. Francia, can you fill us in?
Yes. So two lawmakers visited an ICE facility. It's in the South Loop, where at least 10 people were arrested in recent weeks after showing up for routine check-ins.
Mm-hmm.
These were people who were actively in the immigration system.
Trying to do the right thing.
That's why they were called in for these check-ins, and they were instead arrested and taken to ICE facilities. We still don't know exactly where everyone has gone. So two lawmakers arrived at the location, tried to go and inspect the facility, but instead were turned away once they made their way into the lobby. Allegedly, a person that said he was a member of the ICE turned them away and said they couldn't come. Later on Wednesday, four congressmen from Illinois, all Democrats, tried to visit the ICE Broadview Processing Center, where immigrants have been reported to be held in inhumane conditions. Some of them are the ones who were detained at that ICE South Loop facility. They were also not allowed entry, and they held a press conference after saying that they have congressional oversight based on that law that funds all of these ICE detention centers and all of the Department of Homeland Security's operations, and that they should have been able to come in without giving advance notice to inspect what conditions people are being held in.
Yeah. As you brought up earlier, the president's promise to ramp up deportation specifically in Democratic-led cities. I want to play, though, what Mayor Johnson is saying in response to that.
What we're not in favor of is, you know, seeing grandmothers and grandfathers and mothers and fathers ripped away from children. Little girls being thrown into unmarked vans and taken off to God knows where. That's just inhumane. So we're going to continue to make sure that we're working with community-based organizations and the full force of government to do our part to ensure that people know their rights and that we're doing everything that we can to, you know, to keep families together.
So the city's relaunching its Know Your Rights campaign as the threat of these increased deportations looms, Francia. How else would you say Chicago police and other officials are preparing for what might happen?
Well, aside from the CTA campaign that will be on 400 monitors across the city, reminding people of their constitutional rights and what to do if they are detained or if they see ICE in their neighborhoods, the Mayor Brandon Johnson has called on the city to resist this moment and Advocates and organizers have been canvassing neighborhoods for months, just distributing information to neighbors, Know Your Rights cards, and other things.
Yeah.
It is really hard to prepare because, as Mayor Johnson said, they do not have specific information about where raids might be happening. Some have speculated that it could look something like LA, where these happen at workplaces or Home Depots or different businesses. But it is hard to confirm and hard to prepare. So the city is telling people to be prepared by knowing their rights and being reminded of that,
yeah,
seeking legal advice and working with national and local immigrant justice organizations.
In Paris, the mayor said that he'll, quote, go as far as necessary to protect the Constitution. What exactly might that mean?
Well, protect due process. But when he's saying go as far, by the way, due process is interpreted to mean any resident. I mean, anybody residing in the United States is entitled to due process. Mm-hmm. And we've not seen that in a lot of these ICE actions. ICE has not responded to, we personally have filed Freedom of Information requests. We've asked them, can you give us a list of who the folks are you've detained in the Chicago area, what criminal records they had, and we've gotten nothing from them. So it's all operating in the dark. But, you know, on the other end of this, you don't want to go so far as to politicize the resistance to this. And I get the feeling that some of these lawmakers, you know, want to get arrested, like has happened in New York where the city comptroller got arrested, or what happened in Newark, and that's not happening here, and they're almost goading that to happen. You know, that again is politicizing a very serious issue. And we've got one of the folks, Congressman Roger Krishnamoorthy, who's running for Senate. I'm not saying that's why he was out there doing that, but Durbin today was out there doing it. And so there's just a lot of political noise, and the temperature needs to be taken down all across the situation. But ICE, mm-hmm, ICE has not been transparent.
But to that point, also, the political optics aside, I mean, I think Krishnamoorthy is saying, look, I'm on oversight here. We have a right to do this. And in fact, to your point, Francia, ICE later said, okay, if you lawmakers want to come in, you've got to give us 72 right. hours notice. So mm-hmm. Something came out of it that kind of spoke to due process. But yes, being seen to be turned away is one thing. To be able to sort of say, well, I have a right to be here is part and parcel of how you're supposed to be able to do things, yeah, according to rules in this country. So we'll see how that goes on a little bit more. But I think we're not necessarily going to see that 72 hours rule actually being enforced. Well, let's see if we see those congressmen out there again.
One quick thing. It was very interesting. The local ICE field agent spoke with WGN, and that was a very interesting interview.
And us.
Oh, you, I didn't see that. Just not me.
Or me. Was,
yeah.
Or Francia.
It was the ABC7i team.
Okay.
It was
all
Liz
right.
Nagy who got it. Sorry, I got to just get
all right.
that
no,
in.
All right, no, I didn't see
let's
that.
Let's get it right.
Yeah.
Let's get the credit right.
But that was very interesting,
yeah,
that they're out there now. Perhaps they see the momentum in terms of public perception moving against them, and they need to be out there and be transparent and do more things like that let us know what
that,
they're doing.
That head was very clear. His message was that we're going after people who have orders against them to be deported. They're trying to say that these are the people who, you know, are the criminals, or for whatever reason, they're supposed to be out of here, and they're just not listening to what due process supposedly got for
right.
them.
Let's run through a couple more stories here before we take another pause. Now, a lot of speculation, of course, about Governor Pritzker's presidential ambitions. But another Chicago politician has confirmed he is considering a run for president. What is up with Rahm Emanuel, Revy?
Well, Rahm Emanuel is saying that he said on, I believe, on your station or on Fox, that he said that he's looking at putting his name in name up for consideration, putting his hat in the ring, however you want to say it. He thinks he has something to offer. He says he's been there before. He has been, of course, a White House chief of staff to Barack Obama. He was a senior staffer with President Bill Clinton a generation ago. And, of course, he was the mayor of Chicago for, what was it, 8, 9 years?
8 years, yeah, and, 2 terms.
And just finished up being 4 years of ambassador, United States ambassador to Japan. So he's got really wide-ranging experience, but also when he was in Congress as a congressman from Chicago, he was one of the top leadership people, strategist under Nancy Pelosi, who has always talked about this sort of center lane for the Democratic Party, and has always talked about a more practical, let's not listen to the extremes on right or left and been oriented towards a 50-state sort of winning solution to how the Democratic Party can actually win elections going forward. So as an organizer, formidable. As a guy with experience, formidable. As someone who has a track record that a lot of people can point to,
yeah.
I'm thinking about with regard to the Laquan McDonald situation,
sure.
A lot of vulnerabilities. It will be very interesting
to
see.
This will
be
very interesting.
I think of Rahm Emanuel as sort of like the ultimate technocrat, that he really is. He could be inside or outside. Like in TV, he can be in front of the camera or he can be behind the camera. He is one kind of an operator.
For sure.
It's no accident that this speculation is swirling. It's not happening independent of Rahm Emanuel. Like folks just started talking about it. I mean, he's an expert at ginning up this kind of attention.
Yeah. This was the first week of summer break for CPS students. Yay. And while school might be over, the school drama isn't. I know that you interviewed Paris' outgoing CEO, Pedro Martinez, and he kind of had some tough talk for the teachers union and Mayor Johnson.
He is not holding back, even though he's gone. He's no longer leading Chicago Public Schools. He is leading the entire Massachusetts Department of Education. He's a commissioner there. But he's suing the union president, Stacey Davis Gates, for defamation for some of the incendiary remarks she made about him during these tense union negotiations. He's suing the Board of Education president, Sean Hardin. Basically, what he's saying is CTU tried to exert too much power to control both sides of these negotiations. Really, it was Martinez and his team that stood in the way. I mean, because you have a school board. Remember, the entire school board resigned.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they agreed with Martinez, and they resigned. Johnson very quickly puts together another school board, and he felt like that board was working for the teachers union against him. They're supposed to be representing the district and the taxpayers. And so he's angry about that, and he does believe that this union is exerting too much power, and he does not agree ideologically with them on, finances. I mean, this school district is struggling. It has an imbalanced budget. It seems like the CTU and the mayor still want to take out this $300 million short-term loan, which he has pushed back. He says this is
going
to get us into further trouble, and we need to have more sustainable ways out. So
we'll have to keep eyes on that lawsuit for sure. Six members of a group called Jewish Voices for Peace began a hunger strike outside the federal building on Monday. Revy filled us in.
These are our local activists, and they're joined by some elected officials, at least gathering downtown. But these local activists are with Jewish Voice for Peace, as you say. They convened at Federal Plaza. They say that they are going to go on an indefinite hunger strike to protest the widespread starvation, ironically enough, in the region in Gaza. Six of their members are doing that, as we're understanding it right now. They're putting their bodies on the line to end that starvation. And we'll see if they can continue with this. But, I mean, it is such a strong political move to make a hunger strike at this point and to try to bust through all the other information and all the other headlines that are going on with Iran and Israel. It's all about basically the humanity of what is going on in Gaza. And we've talked about it. All news organizations, all media have talked about it. But to talk about how literally how much human life is being lost in Gaza, this is how they think they can do it.
Former Loreto Hospital executive is accused of defrauding the federal government of almost $300 million. Francia, this was a Block Club investigation that exposed everything here. Get us up to speed.
Yeah, so a lot of wrongdoing in Loreto Hospital, but the latest that was revealed is that the former CEO and CFO was charged for allegedly participating in a fake COVID test scheme that would have asked for the federal government to reimburse him and three other people for $300 million for COVID tests that were fake or were never taken.
Mm-hmm.
This apparently he and his co-conspirators took personal data from patients to then submit claims for uninsured patients for COVID tests that were never performed.
So he allegedly, Anash Ahmed, allegedly stole patient data and used it to get federal reimbursement.
Right. And this is separate to the other charges he has faced for everything he's done at the hospital, which is a long list from 2021 to 2022, including vaccinating people at the Trump Tower and at a Gold Coast jewelry store.
Mm-hmm. I remember this being the big story when I first got to town and started here. And I'm like, this is still going. And he's currently a fugitive.
Yes, he fled to Dubai.
Okay. All right. Mm. Another COVID testing scandal, believe it or not, in the news this week. This one, Revy, involves a South Suburban man. What happened here?
That's right. That is Zeeshan Alvi, 46 years old, of Inverness. And he pleaded guilty to one count of wire fraud last year, admitting in this plea agreement that that his lab fraudulently billed for hundreds of millions of dollars in government reimbursements at the height of the pandemic, 2021, 2022, ultimately collecting some $14 million in illegitimate taxpayer back payments. He falsified tens of thousands of tests. He told these anxious patients at the height of the pandemic that they were negative, when in fact many of the specimens had just been tossed in the garbage. Mm-mm. And this was a fraud of a massive scale. The government, the judge calling it. People were scrambling to get COVID tests. They didn't want to imperil the safety of their friends and loved ones. And it was like a passport. It was like a passport. If you got a negative test, it was like a passport. You could go and meet your loved ones. And that was the fraud that he said that they just were fraudulent about their lab results, throwing things in the garbage. And what was interesting here was that this man, Mr. Alvi, had overcome great odds, coming from Pakistan as an immigrant and making a life for himself, a very successful businessman, trying to help in the middle of the pandemic. And he just, the judge said, look, you just got completely over your skis, completely mm-hmm. greedy, and went down this criminal path. Yeah. So 7 years in jail.
Yeah. Let's turn to sports then, Paris, because the Chicago Fire, they unveiled plans for a new stadium that they recently announced that they're going to build in the South Loop. What do we know so far?
$650 million that they're going to foot the bill for themselves.
That's not cheap.
Wealthy owner Joe Mansueto, owner of Morningstar. This is his project, although the 78, that parcel of land just south of the Loop, bordered by Clark and Roosevelt and the river, it's needed development. It's a prime piece of real estate, and it has a TIF, a tax increment financing district, where there's hundreds of millions of dollars that can go toward infrastructure. So this is the thing. They'll pay for the stadium, but mm-hmm. then the city will be able to pay for things like roads and plumbing and all the kind of ancillary things that will need to happen. I mean, there might be some public plazas or parks. And the other thing about this is the White Sox really lost out.
Yeah.
I mean, they had first proposed
they wanted that space.
Beautiful looking baseball park there. And well, the thing is, their owner, Jerry Reinsdorf, wanted the taxpayers to pay for every last cent of it. I mean, come on. What era are we living in right now? And he's been successful in the past.
And this is
it.
While where they play right now was also supported with taxpayer funds, and which are not completely paid off yet.
Not paid off. And he reaps the pride. The taxpayers have paid for renovations there. I mean, this is a different era. And Reinsdorf has been so successful in the past getting stadiums built for free. He thought he could do it again.
Yeah.
But there's this new owner, Justin Ishbia, our new stakeholder that might become the majority owner. It seems like he wants to inject some money in it to build a stadium. Let's see if the White Sox try to jump aboard and say, let's build two stadiums
right.
on this beautiful
Can they still
part
be called the South Siders if they're in that 78 neighborhood?
Well, it's still right. south of Madison. Madison is zero.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
hey, if they were on like the south side of Madison, they're still typically the South Siders. So.
Yeah, well, yeah. Good point.
There you go.
So here's a
I know
fun...
a lot of people would argue with
they
that.
They would argue, absolutely.
Francia, here's a fun headline to hear during Pride Month. An iconic Lakeview bar could become the first gay bar inside a U.S. airport. What are the details?
Yes, we're talking about Sidetrack, one of the largest and most popular gay bars in the city. And they have applied to open a spot in O'Hare Airport, which would mean it's, as you said, the first U.S. bar. U.S. gay bar in mm-hmm. an airport.
It's a huge deal.
It is a huge deal. The owners and a local hospitality group called Summer's Hospitality Group have made the bid for that space. It's still months away to know if this will be happening.
Oh, so not a done deal yet.
Not a done deal yet, but we know that the owners of Sidetrack, which is currently open, are very excited about this. They have long fought for LGBTQ+ rights, and they are very excited about the possibility of showing that acceptance and diversity at the airport. By the way, Chicago was named the, I think, safest city for travelers, for LGBTQ+ travelers this year. So it would kind of go hand in hand.
And to be clear, I think they want to be clear that this is a bar for everybody, if should it get that concession at the airport. That would be really quite something.
Yeah, but an exciting move forward, and we'll definitely keep an eye on how this goes. Today, though, is the first day of summer. Did you feel it on your way in?
I was...
Because we went straight from this this cool spring to some dangerous heat.
I did. I'm sweating pretty bad because I took a scooter here, one of those electric scooters, and then it broke down and I ran the rest of the way to do the live shot for Channel 32 and then come in here. So yes, I'm feeling it.
Had but to I do the shameless plug, didn't you?
I had to get that in. But yes, I think we're all going to feel it this weekend, and so that beach is going to look real, real appetizing.
Can I just say, we actually, I've not seen this for a long time on Channel 7. We have these AccuWeather alert days, you know, the big red graphic comes out, and Larry Mowry put out three in a row for this, and I haven't seen that, I don't know, since the blizzard of 2012 or something.
The heat caused serious problems at Uptown's Weiss Memorial Hospital Monday. The air conditioner broke, and it forced the hospital to transfer all 45 of its mainly elderly patients to other medical centers. Weiss officials, they're saying that it may be weeks before the air conditioner is actually functioning again. Terrible. And for anyone listening who's looking for a place to cool down this weekend, the city's going to have cooling centers open as the temperatures are going to hit the high 90s.
Mm-hmm. The real feel is going to be up in the like 102, 105 maybe in certain cases. People have got to drink water.
Yes.
If you're outside, you got to be, you know, be careful about that. And you've got to recognize if you're not sweating and you're hot and you're outside and you're not sweating, you are dehydrated. So make sure you take precautions.
How do you guys like to stay cool? Is it the pool, the beach?
Well, the pools are opening this weekend.
All Chicago pools
are opening.
All 50 of them.
They're going to be packed.
They're going to be packed.
7 days a week for the first time since 2020.
Amazing.
Mind you.
And the beaches are going to be packed as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So be water-wise, folks.
Yeah, and for anyone who does want to be out and about this weekend, but they do want to avoid driving and traffic, CTA Metra and Pace, they've launched a new regional day pass. Mm-hmm. It's available on the latest version of the Ventra app, and it allows unlimited rides in a single day. All right, folks, we've covered it all. That's it for the weekly news recap.
Can I just say one thing?
I've been
hearing about all your pledge drives. Keep it going.
Yes, thank you.
I'm pledging right up there, more than $1 a day, $2 a day from the Beachwall household for Chicago Public Media.
Support public media.
I didn't even wear my hat today. But
thank you, Rebby. And we didn't even rehearse that. Look at that.
No, I've been dying to say that.
My thanks to Rebby Beachwall of ABC7, Francia Garcia Hernandez of Block Club Chicago, and Paris Schutz of Fox 32.
Have a great weekend.
Oh, wow. Sunshine. This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Meha Ahmed and mixed by Ari Mejia. Every Friday, Reset brings you the news you need to know in under an hour. But if you want a few updates throughout the week, sign up for our newsletter. It comes out on Mondays and Fridays, and you can subscribe at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening. We'll meet again tomorrow.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.